The launch, May 6, 1998. With the launch of the original Macintosh in 1984, Jobs had created a new kind of theater. The product debut as an epical event, climaxed by a let there be light moment in which the skies part, a light shines down, the angels sing, and a chorus of the chosen faithful sings Hallelujah. For the grand unveiling of the product that he hoped would save Apple and again transform personal computing, Jobs symbolically chose the Flint Auditorium of De Anza Community College in Cupertino, the same venue he had used in 1984. He would be pulling out all the stops in order to dispel doubts, rally the troops, enlist support in the developers' community, and jumpstart the marketing of the new machine. But he was also doing it because he enjoyed playing impresario. Putting on a great show piqued his passions in the same way as putting out a great product. Displaying his sentimental side, he began with a graceful shout-out to three people he had invited to be up front in the audience. He had become estranged from all of them, but now he wanted them rejoined. I started the company with Steve Wozniak in my parents' garage, and Steve is here today, he said, pointing him out and prompting applause. We were joined by Mike Markula, and soon after that, our first president, Mike Scott, he continued. Both of those folks are in the audience today, and none of us would be here without these three guys. His eyes misted for a moment as the applause again built. Also in the audience were Andy Hertzfeld and most of the original Mac team. Jobs gave them a smile. He believed he was about to do them proud. After showing the grid of Apple's new product strategy and going through some slides about the new computer's performance, he was ready to unveil his new baby. "This is what computers look like today," he said as a picture of a beige set of boxy components and monitor was projected on the big screen behind him. "And I'd like to take the privilege of showing you what they are going to look like from today on." He pulled the cloth from the table at center stage to reveal the new iMac, which gleamed and sparkled as the lights came up on cue. He pressed the mouse, and as at the launch of the original Macintosh, the screen flashed with fast-paced images of all the wondrous things the computer could do. At the end, the word Hello appeared in the same playful script that had adorned the 1984 Macintosh, this time with the word Again below it in parentheses. Hello, again. There was thunderous applause. Jobs stood back and proudly gazed at his new Macintosh. "It looks like it's from another planet," he said as the audience laughed. "A good planet. A planet with better designers." Once again, Jobs had produced an iconic new product, this one a harbinger of a new millennium. It fulfilled the promise of think different. Instead of beige boxes and monitors with a welter of cables and a bulky setup manual, here was a friendly and spunky appliance, smooth to the touch and as pleasing to the eye as a robin's egg. You could grab its cute little handle and lift it out of the elegant white box and plug it right into a wall socket. People who had been afraid of computers now wanted one, and they wanted to put it in a room where others could admire it and perhaps covet it. A piece of hardware that blends sci-fi shimmer with a kitsch whimsy of a cocktail umbrella, Stephen Levy wrote in Newsweek. It is not only the coolest-looking computer introduced in years, but a chest-thumping statement that Silicon Valley's original dream company is no longer somnambulant. Forbes called it an industry-altering success, and John Sculley later came out of exile to gush, "He has implemented the same simple strategy that made Apple so successful 15 years ago. Make hit products and promote them with terrific marketing." Carping was heard from only one familiar corner. As the iMac garnered kudos, Bill Gates assured a gathering of financial analysts visiting Microsoft that this would be a passing fad. "The one thing Apple's providing now is leadership in colors," Gates said, as he pointed to a Windows-based PC that he jokingly had painted red. "It won't take long for us to catch up with that, I don't think." Jobs was furious, and he told a reporter that Gates, the man he had publicly decried for being completely devoid of taste, was clueless about what made the iMac so much more appealing than other computers. "The thing that our competitors are missing is that they think it's about fashion, and they think it's about surface appearance," he said. "They say, we'll slap a little color on this piece of junk computer, and we'll have one too." The iMac went on sale in August 1998 for $1,299. It sold 278,000 units in its first 6 weeks, and it would sell 800,000 by the end of the year, making it the fastest-selling computer in Apple history. Most notably, 32% of the sales went to people who were buying a computer for the first time, and another 12% to people who had been using Windows machines. Ive soon came up with four new juicy-looking colors in addition to Bondi Blue for the iMacs. Offering the same computer in five colors would, of course, create huge challenges for manufacturing, inventory, and distribution. At most companies, including even the old Apple, there would have been studies and meetings to look at the costs and benefits. But when Jobs looked at the new colors, he got totally psyched and summoned other executives over to the design studio. "We're going to do all sorts of colors," he told them excitedly. When they left, Ive looked at his team in amazement. "In most places, that decision would have taken months," Ive recalled. "Steve did it in a half hour." There was one other important refinement that Jobs wanted for the iMac: getting rid of that detested CD tray. "I've seen a slot load drive on a very high-end Sony stereo," he said, "so I went to the drive manufacturers and got them to do a slot load drive for us for the version of the iMac we did 9 months later." Rubinstein tried to argue him out of the change. He predicted that new drives would come along that could burn music onto CDs rather than merely play them, and they would be available in tray form before they were made to work in slots. "If you go to slots, you will always be behind on the technology," Rubinstein argued. "I don't care, that's what I want," Jobs snapped back. They were having lunch at a sushi bar in San Francisco, and Jobs insisted that they continue the conversation over a walk. "I want you to do the slot load drive for me as a personal favor," Jobs asked. Rubinstein agreed, of course, but he turned out to be right. Panasonic came out with a CD drive that could rip and burn music, and it was available first for computers that had old-fashioned tray loaders. The effects of this would ripple over the next few years. It would cause Apple to be slow in catering to users who wanted to rip and burn their own music, but that would then force Apple to be imaginative and bold in finding a way to leapfrog over its competitors when Jobs finally realized that he had to get into the music market.